Welcome.
Thank you.
Are you a first-timer?
I am.
So grab a seat. Adjust the mic, if you would, so that it's at your level. You'll have 3 minutes, and all we need is your name, and you're free to talk about any subject you'd like. Welcome.
Perfect. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Ben McKinley. I am a founder and CEO of Cascade Web Development. I'm here to thank you for all of your efforts in support of small business, and I want to encourage you to continue this great work. I want to share with you my business success story and provide a challenge. Cascade was founded in 2001. My team worked from remote offices in the Portland area and surrounding suburbs for 5 years before we secured some office space in inner southeast Portland. Since that time, we've benefited greatly from a number of programs supported by the city, PDC, PBA, and Greater Portland, Inc. A separate company of mine, BrandLive, also secured some working capital funding from PDC. All of this hard work and support has resulted in a thriving business. We have 7 full-time employees. We work with another half dozen contractors on a part-time basis as needed, and that need has been growing recently. We're looking to bring some more development staff online this year. And this has there's been a lot of dedication to this cause from both our staff as well as the larger community. Thank you for your contribution to our success on a micro and macro level. Like many small businesses, access to capital is a challenge. Well, it's great to see that there's been a lot of support and discussion about increased access to capital. I think there has to be an equal, if not larger, focus on access to mentorship. The culture of, my view on that is basically, you know, if you've got access to capital but not a whole lot of direction and oversight, it's kind of like throwing money to children and hoping that issues kind of go away. I think that ongoing nurturing the support and the guidance of proven mentors is a critical piece of the puzzle. Last week, I was invited to a luncheon that was put on by SAO, PDC, and the Oregon Israeli Business Association. They invited John Medved to come and speak with us. Jonathan is an American-born tech entrepreneur who's lived in Israel for the last 30-plus years, taken a number of companies public and really ingrained himself in what has allowed Israel to become what is now known as Startup Nation. And in that luncheon, I was asking him, you know, as he was kind of connecting the dots on what has led to their success, and one of the big things is a very flat culture, very easy access to people at very high levels and their interest to pay it forward when younger entrepreneurs come up and are looking for that kind of guidance. And I think that there's a lot that we can learn from that. I know that there's a best practices trip going over there next year. I'm hoping to be a part of that, and I just hope that we can continue to learn from some of those things as it relates to mentorship. As the good work of supporting small businesses and the larger mission of job growth, please keep mentorship in mind. Thank you again, Mayor and Commissioners, for all of your work in supporting small business. I ask that you continue to fund strategic programs such as a Small Business Development Center, storefront improvement grants, and microloans for startup companies. Please also continue to advocate for a favorable business environment by reducing taxes and fees that are burdensome for small businesses. As you know, Portland's economy is significantly tied to the growth and success of small business. A couple of data points to wrap up my points. Small business represents 95% of all firms and employs 254,000 people with a payroll of approximately $2.1 billion a year. Nearly 3/4 of the net new jobs in Portland are created by small business. Our success depends on your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKinley. Sue, would you please read item number 52.
Request of Shedrick J. Wilkins to address council regarding homelessness, churches used for homeless people, and Dignity Village.
Is Mr. Wilkins in? Okay. Would you please read council item 53.
Request of Robert Cross to address council regarding disability and disabled parking placards.
Mr. Krause, are you here? I think the weather is probably conspiring this morning. Okay, let's move to council item 54.
Request of Nancy Newell to address council regarding discontinuance of permit process by Portland Water Bureau in Clackamas County concerning Bull Run Water Project.
Ms. Newell, welcome. You have 3 minutes, and all we need is your name.
Nancy Newell. Yes, I'm here today because I did distribute a letter via the city clerk to each one of you and have not received any response on Kenneth Helm, who is in conflict of interest because he has been paid by the city of Portland City of Portland is the applicant, and that's a clear violation, contrary to Mr. Thatcher, who represents the City Water Bureau, and replied within the hearing process that the hearing officer is not a business and cited various statutes, and there are other conditions that he cited that don't apply. So we will continue. We stopped a December 20th decision that was a rush decision. We don't see why you're rushing. This was initiated by Mr. Glicker of the Portland Water Bureau. It enlisted the assistance of NOAA. This is not a project that is needed. We have proven, and it is contradictory to the variance process with the state to go forward with these projects, not to mention the damage and the introduction of invasive species, which are not removed from water pressure cleaning of construction equipment that enters that area. So you have several levels of legal issues. I've won in federal court contradicting the county lawyer. We won our case. I will contradict your decisions on this council on allowing this budget to go forward, $35 million in unanimous decision, and we will take action. We are not a special interest group. There are several citizens, contrary to your blog, that are very concerned about the quality of water, how the water money is being spent, the consultants being used. This is a multinational group that has only one interest in that. That's its profit margin and control of our water and the eventual privatization of our water. You have heard on corporate personhood. You have been directed in many ways by the citizens of this city. And this city is losing population and revenue. And I know that you're driving revenue in order to keep it stable. But that's not the way to do it, by risking our water quality. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Newell. Next, we'll take up the consent agenda. Does any member of council want to remove any item from the consent agenda? Hearing none, does any member of the public wish to remove any item from the consent agenda? Okay, Sue, would you please call the roll?
Fritz.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Salzman.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
The agenda passes. We have two time certains this morning. The first is scheduled for 9:30. We're right on time. Sue, would you please read Council Item 55?
55, accept report of the Customer Service Advisory Committee.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, President Fish. I have the honor of introducing John Dutt, the chair of the Customer Service Advisory Committee. Please come forward. The Office of Neighborhood Involvement helps staff this committee. It's a multi-bureau committee, so we are all responsible for this report and its implementations. And I am very grateful that you do continue to come back and give us the annual report with updates on how we are doing in all of the bureaus on customer service and what we might do to improve. Mr. Dutt.
Thank you. Actually, we're going to start our brief presentation with Elisa Kaur.
Good morning, Council. My name is Elisa Kaur with Portland Fire and Rescue, and I'm here today with John Dutt, Neighborhood Involvement, and Ross Carone, Bureau of Development Services. The Citywide Customer Service Advisory Committee was created in 2006 to work with bureaus to improve customer service and implement the recommendations of Bureau Improvement Bureau Innovation Project Number 7. Since its inception, the committee has worked with bureaus to improve customer service by focusing on three key areas. Those three key areas are incorporating customer service elements into bureaus' mission statements and strategic plans, also improved customer service feedback mechanisms, and customer service focus in workforce hiring, training, and evaluation. Every year, bureaus have been asked to give an annual update on their efforts in these areas. These efforts are what committee's annual report summarizes and highlights. The committee has also created a website, www.portlandonline.com/CSAC, to serve primarily as a toolkit resource where we capture examples of the good work being done across city bureaus and share those with other bureaus and also with other cities. It's an open website to the public. This year's report updates ongoing customer and service improvement efforts by city bureaus, and over the past 5 years, there was increased and renewed emphasis on customer service, coinciding in great part with the advent of BIP number 7 and of this committee. There were several bureaus that were early adopters, while several others took a couple of years to fully develop their customer service improvement efforts. And at this point, we can say that much progress has been made in the area of incorporation of customer service values into bureaus' missions, values, and goal statements. There are also many examples of bureaus that have developed customer service-focused strategic plans, and new and, in some cases, enhanced customer feedback mechanisms were implemented by a number of the bureaus. Also, enhanced customer service emphasis in bureau-specific workforce development has been pretty universal across the bureaus. You have the report before you, and it will be available to everyone through our website, so we don't want to take a lot of time to go over the details of the report, but what you'll find in general is a bureau-by-bureau update of individual efforts, as well as a balanced scorecard of visual representation into the bureau's efforts in terms of what they've accomplished, what's ongoing, and also where there's still progress to be made or items that have not yet been embarked upon by the bureaus. While there's been a lot of good progress over the past 5 years, there's unfortunately been some areas where progress has been slower than the committee had hoped or stagnant within particular parts of the city, and I'm going to pass it off to Ross Carone to talk about some of those challenges.
Morning, Council. My name is Ross Carone with the Bureau of Development Services. Today I'm presenting to Council concerning some of the budget challenges that have come up in the last few years. Unfortunately, with the economic downturn of the past few years, budgets have tightened up across the city. This has had impacts on customer service in some areas. Budget reductions often result in service and staff cuts, affecting basic frontline services, hours of operations, phone coverage, and response times. As Council knows, the Bureau of Development Services felt these impacts early on in the economic recession. We had to reduce staff and, along with that, make changes to many of our service levels and turnaround goals. In the face of those changes, the Bureau of Development Services maintained its focus on customer service. The importance of customer service was continually communicated by Director Scarlett and the BDS leadership team to the staff and customers of the Bureau of Development Services. We worked on making efficiencies throughout the Bureau to continue providing as highest level of customer service possible. Some examples were the bundling of inspection requests, the expansion of our online trade permit program, and the creation of our online tall grass and weeds complaint program. Service level changes were also communicated to our customers in a clear and consistent manner through service level update documents that were posted online and in customer service areas. Outside of the Bureau of Development Services, the Customer Service Advisory Committee has started to see some curtailing of customer service improvement efforts due to budget restrictions. For example, customer service training and customer survey efforts have been impacted. Many smaller bureaus have struggled to be strategic in their customer service improvements with limited staff to dedicate to such priorities. In some of the larger bureaus, they've been able to maintain customer service training with dedicated staff. The committee is hopeful that the current Bureau of Human Resources effort to reestablish a citywide training program will result in greater opportunities for all bureaus and city staff, regardless of budgets. Thank you very much. And next is John.
All right. John Dutt with Office of Neighborhood Involvement. I manage the City-County Information Referral Program, 823-4000. Shameless plug. In addition to the budget limitations that Ross discussed a little bit, the committee, through our work with the bureaus, also recognizes the city does not always have in place the best customer management and service delivery systems. The Customer Service Advisory Committee continues to note that there exists significant opportunities for customer service improvement related to improving these systems. At present, the city lacks a central customer relationship management database, and each bureau manages their customer relationships and service requests independently. This has resulted in a significant duplication of efforts and lost opportunities for service coordination. The customer management systems in existence vary across the city. Some are pretty robust, while others are pretty rudimentary, but virtually none of these systems are linked. We believe that the city could benefit from a robust customer relationship management system that could be used where appropriate citywide to manage customer requests for services and make it easier for community members to request services as well as track the progress of those requests. As resources allow, the committee sees value in Council giving consideration to formally researching the advantages and disadvantages of a citywide customer relationship management system, a tool which is in common use in many private and public sector organizations, including over 70 311 programs in cities across the United States. In conclusion, for our report, we want to thank the City Bureau staff for the progress that has been made and encourage them to keep up the good work. We also want to encourage City Council and Bureau leaders to do their best to maintain customer service priorities as we go through yet another difficult budget development process. We believe in difficult times that good customer service is particularly vital because the best way to mitigate the impact of necessitated service reductions and retain public support is to do our best to prioritize meeting the basic customer service needs of our constituents when deciding how to allocate scarce resources. And that's the end of our formal presentation, but we wanted to give opportunity for council to ask any questions of us. Or
so I have a question. And first, thank you for a very clear written report. I understand how the various categories, you have a scorecard at the end,
right?
And there's seven specific categories under two broad headings of Bureau practices and workforce development. I guess I understand how they all apply to the bureaus. I'm less clear how they apply to individual commissioners' offices. And since you've graded enough, you've graded all the offices as being largely either incomplete or not completed in a number of these categories, I guess I would turn it around and ask you how strategic plan, for example, and surveying, in as two examples, how those are applicable to council offices, or whether we ought to have maybe two sets of criteria here.
Sure. Yeah, it is definitely a little different to report on the commissioner's and mayor's offices because you're not helping people pay water bills or reserve parks necessarily. But so what we look at a lot, and again, this report reflects the efforts reported to us by the bureaus and the offices. And it's not an evaluation of how well bureaus or offices are providing customer service. Rather, it's an evaluation of the efforts. Are they doing certain things? So, for example, you mentioned surveying. You know, some bureaus have pretty formal surveying mechanisms in place. Some bureaus have done things like focus groups or formal complaint processes, even instituting those. So, you know, like with the elected officials' offices, a lot of times what we look at is, you know, is there a mechanism in place to getting feedback from constituents and tracking those, and, you know, how formalized is that? And that seems to vary a little bit across the offices. So
I guess this is just food for thought as you continue to refine your good work. I think offices with six or seven employees are so quantitatively different than bureaus with hundreds of employees. I mean, I doubt any of us are going to do a strategic plan per se, and we do training, but perhaps not of the system-wide training that a bureau does. And there just might be a different set of criteria or a more useful set that's applicable to offices, because it doesn't seem that each category applies neatly to the ones that apply to bureaus apply to commissioners' offices. And you may disagree with that. I'd like to carry on the conversation because we're always interested in learning better ways of communicating with people. But we're an office of six or seven, and we represent almost 600,000 people. So any suggestions for how we can be more responsive? But it just strikes me as we're comparing apples and oranges when we throw offices in with bureaus. So just something.
If I might respond to that, I found the categorization quite helpful with the last report, and thought about the criteria that we're being and the standards that we're being asked to meet. So although they may not entirely match, they gave my office food for thought and looking at what do we do in training, what do we do in feedback mechanisms, how do we make sure that everything we put into all the customer requests that we have are tracked and responded to in one way or another. So I agree, Commissioner Fish, that it's not exactly the same. However, I have found it very helpful to be guided, and maybe there should be additional criteria for commissioners' offices as to how much office hopping we have to do. I noticed in Commissioner Leonard's report, your staff are very committed to making sure that the customer's issue is resolved. And I think that's the case for all of our offices. So it would be interesting to have some measurement of that. I also wonder, how did you determine, who did you talk to in each of the council offices to come up with the evaluation?
Sure. I guess one thing we didn't mention in the report is, so our committee, I think right now we have 13 people on our committee, and we sort of break ourselves up into what we call site teams. So we assign each of us to work with particular bureaus, be sort of a resource for those bureaus. So every, as Elisa mentioned in her summary, we ask the bureaus and the offices to submit to us a little update every year as part of the budget process, which has gotten a lot better over the years because bureaus are more used to doing that. But so usually somebody in each of the bureaus or offices submits that report, and it's usually the person we'll have dialogue with, you know, because a lot of times we get the report and then we have additional follow-up questions, so we'll contact them. So I know in each of your offices there are particular people that have filled out those reports and that we've had dialogue with. So we're obviously happy to work with any bureau or any office, you know, to talk about kind of what Commissioner Fish has brought up and how, you know, maybe we could improve the reporting and improve the feedback, too, that we get out of the offices or the bureaus.
So. Do any of the offices send a representative to the committee meetings?
Yeah. We do have, let's see, right now I know George Hawker comes to some of the meetings.
We had a representative from the mayor's office for a while, their public advocate.
That yes. I know Stacey Brewer came to some meetings as well.
Right.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Brewster, yeah.
Were you through? So I had a question. Your talk about sort of a uniform customer service response improvement approach, and then you mentioned 311. I guess, could you just give me a thumbnail capsule of what 311 is, and is that what you're saying we should have, and that would be a
well, I think we're saying that what the committee's saying is that we think it, there's value in looking at.
And what is 311?
Well, there's kind of two pieces, actually. There's the customer relationship management system, which is sort of the backbone that a lot of cities have used to build a 311 system off of. So 311 is just a phone number you can call. I mean, right now we have city county information referral 8234000, which is kind of like a mini 311 in terms of, you know, you can call us and we'll help you figure out how to do what you need to do. What's different, I guess, with 311, cities that have implemented that is, you know, 80 to 90% of the time you call 311, tell them what your issue is, and they can enter your service request, answer your questions, and take care of it. Whereas right now they call 8234000, and 80 to 90% of the time we have to transfer it to a particular hotline within the city or county to make their service request. We don't have that system in place where we can actually, you know, enter their service request, get it to the inspector or the dispatch or whatever with that one call.
The 311 systems have that capability then?
Yes.
For the call takers to basically enter a
work
order or a complaint, I guess, or something.
So, and that's based on this common customer relationship management system that's in place citywide. So, like right now, all of our bureaus kind of have their own ways of managing those requests and tracking those requests, and what the cities that have used the common CRM or the 311 in conjunction with that, it's allowed for the bureaus to all be kind of intermingled with that common system. I mean, they may still have their own systems to handle certain things, but they integrate with that common system so that there's not as much duplication of efforts in terms of, you know, we dispatch two crews to the same problem that sometimes happens, or, you know, sharing information about a problem property or managing it.
You know, it's interesting. I visited 211 call center a week ago or so, and I had a chance to observe live calls coming in, and the calls that were that I observed had to do with food, hunger, shelter, and energy assistance. So there were people that were trying to get emergency food, people who were at risk of having their electricity shut off, or people who were looking for shelter. And they have these highly trained people that then help folks navigate through opportunities that the city, the county, or nonprofits and faith community providers have, and actually diagnose the problem, give people referral information, And then they do a follow-up. They actually call people back as part of their quality control system just to see, you know, did you get the relief you were seeking and the like. And plus all their databases are regularly updated, and it's quite an interesting system. And I guess I hadn't fully appreciated how much of both the city and county services are covered by 211. That would otherwise maybe come to an individual commissioner's office or to a bureau, and how effective they are at channeling people. And it's updated daily with information about level of service, how many vouchers does someone have, you know, how much food is left, you know, and what also what's the most proximate place for people to go. Asking questions like, do you have a car? Are you dependent on public transportation? And then thinking about distance and childcare issues is quite extraordinary. So I've always been we fund 211, and it's a great service, particularly on the housing side. But I'm very impressed at the scope of the work and how customized they can deal with individual people's concerns.
So when Commissioner Leonard was in charge of the Bureau of Communications, he had been very interested in doing a 311 system. When I took over in 2009, that was the beginning of the recession, and we didn't have the money to expand services. We were cutting. As we look to climbing out of the recession, I believe, as you said, Commissioner Fish, that it would be very much better to have a 311 system. It wouldn't replace 211. 211 would continue to be for social services, but it would be the one number for people to call for non-emergencies in the City of Portland, Portland Development Commission, and others. So my office is going to be pulling together a task force to start looking again at what such a system might look like, how it might be organized, how much it would cost, so that when we do have resources available, we're ready to move on that. The reason that's connected in some ways with the Emergency Communications Bureau is that we get a lot of calls, and it's the same operators who answer 911 as answer 823-3333. So it would be much better for the emergency communication system if there were a different number. And research has shown that people are much more likely to dial three numbers than they are to dial 10. So we would be able to get people's calls directed much, much better. It will require some a lot of prior work within the city to make sure that our answers are standardized and that it's clear who can answer that question and what the answer will be. So I think there's an opportunity before we can actually purchase the software and do the reorganization that would need to do that to look at customer service and how to prepare for that 311 system. But I would greatly appreciate your consideration, colleagues, of looking forward to purchasing such a system and reorganizing in that manner. And I invite you to send representatives from your office to our task force.
Is there other council discussion? So you've presented a report. You'd like us to accept the report, I take it. So is there a motion to accept the report?
Do we have any testimony?
Oh, excuse me. Any testimony?
Ben McKinley signed up. I believe he's gone on his way now. He spoke earlier.
Very good. I'll accept a motion.
Move to accept the report.
Is there a second? The motion has been made and seconded. Sue, would you please call the roll?
Fritz.
Well, since Commissioner Fish drew our attention to the table at the end, I need to commend the Revenue Bureau and Parks and Recreation for being perfect, getting a perfect report card. That shows it can be done. And I very much appreciate the work of the committee. This is not your primary job for any of the members who serve on this committee, and yet you are diligent in getting together and giving us both the report and suggestions for improvement. So I have appreciated that and have used your advice to improve the operations in my office, and I will continue to do so. So thank you very much. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, thank you for this thorough report. I will take your recommendations to heart about my office in particular and how we can do better with the next scorecard ourselves. And I do, as Commissioner Fritz noted, the OMF Revenue Bureau and the Parks Recreation seem to have done everything right and gotten good accolades, and they deserve that. But thanks for calling this to attention, and thanks for your work. And Lisa, I want to thank you for your Fire and Rescue newsletter. You know, it's nice to have a face to go with a name. I get that every month or so, and
excellent.
Now I know who you are.
Yeah.
So, but it's a great.
It's a little heavy on Randy Leonard materials.
Oh.
We'd be probably a little more interested in the rank and file, but
It's well done.
Take that into consideration for the next issue.
I understand.
No, it's very well done. So thank you all for your work. And 8234,000, you guys do a fantastic job.
Thank you.
Aye.
Leonard.
Thank you. Aye.
Fish.
Thank you for an outstanding report. Thanks to George Hawker from my office participating. We've actually done something new and different, and it's in part based on this interactive process. We had a public advocate before in my office. Now we have a dedicated person who handles constituent communications. And between the two of them, they are, you know, spending the bulk of their time addressing concerns that come in, playing traffic cop, getting responses, bird-dogging problems that come up. And, you know, this is a process of continual improvement, and we all have a lot to learn. But thank you for your good work. Aye. The report is accepted. Thank you very much. We have another time certain this morning at 10. Sue, would you please read Council Item 56?
Appoint David Daugherty to the Fire and Police Disability and Retirement Board of Trustees for a term to expire December 31, 2013.
Thank you very much. I have a brief opening statement. Mr. Daugherty, if you please come forward. Welcome. Let me just tee it up as follows. Mayor Adams sends his regrets. He had hoped to be here to formally move your nomination, but as you know, he's traveling in Washington, D.C. today. And so because there's a board meeting scheduled for January 24th and a desire to have a full complement, he's asked us to proceed with this matter on your nomination. I want to begin by thanking the commissioner liaison to FPD&R, Commissioner Dan Saltzman, for his leadership on the charter reforms of the past and his continued work with the fund today. The FPD&R fund was established for the benefit of the sworn employees of Portland Fire and Rescue and the Bureau of Police of the City of Portland. In June of 2006, the City Council referred a series of charter amendments to the voters. These were reforms to the FPD&R fund and were overwhelmingly approved by the voters in November of 2006 with an 81% vote. One of the charter amendments that was approved by the voters was the appointment of a 5-person board of trustees, including 2 citizen trustees, and that's the position that you've been nominated for. Today, the mayor brings forth his nominee for filling the open citizen trustee position for the purpose of serving the remainder of the term of former trustee Jeffrey Robertson, which would be through December 31st, 2011. When the mayor...
2012.
Excuse me, I was going to say thank you for your service. let's move forward. Through 2012.
13.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think I need a new set of glasses. Through 2013. When the mayor was looking for a nominee, there were certain criteria that he applied. First, he was looking for someone who has a significant experience in pension and actuarial work that the charter specifically identifies as being a criteria for the citizen trustee. Second, he was looking for someone with the analytical skills matched by an objective approach to problem solving. And finally, he was looking for someone who could understand all aspects of the fund, including how it could be a good steward for current and future generations of fire and police workers. Needless to say, the mayor also wanted to ensure that his nominee would have broad support of his council colleagues. In Dave Daugherty, we have before us a gentleman with over 30 years of pension experience, including consulting on 2 Taft-Hartley pension funds, one with the Northwest Bricklayers and the other with the Oregon Foundry Workers. Dave and I had the chance to have a conversation prior to his nomination, and I was very impressed with the breadth of his public and private experience, and also, frankly, with his work on a Taft-Hartley fund. And that's a specific term of art, but in my experience, looking back over 2.5 decades, The kind of skills you need to have an effective Taft-Hartley fund are the ability to work across the aisle, if you will. Taft-Hartley funds are not successful if labor or management gets their way. They work effectively when labor and management come together for the benefit of the employees and with the eye on the long-term health of the fund. And the fact you've had that particular experience was very noteworthy for me. We are grateful that you've considered, you have agreed to have your name placed in nomination. This is a significant undertaking. And Dave, I welcome you to say a few words about your experience and why you're interested in serving.
Okay. Thank you very much. I am Dave Doherty, and just a little bit about me. I've been a resident of Portland for 35 years, I think, now, having come up from California to attend Lewis and Clark College. But anyway, I have operated businesses in the Portland area for about 18 years or so. My profession is as an actuary. I'm a fellow in the Society of Actuaries, a member of the American Academy of Actuaries, and also an enrolled actuary under ERISA. My practice over the years has encompassed a number of areas, but most of them related to retirement and retiree health plans. That is, as an actuarial consultant to those plans. So I've worked with corporate sponsors of private pension plans. I've worked with sponsors of 401k and defined contribution plans. I've worked with public sector plans. And as you noted, I've worked with Taft-Hartley or jointly trusteed plans as well. So I think I bring to the board, obviously, a lot of experience from the actuarial, maybe analytical, number crunching side. But I think also I've, over the 30 years, I've had the opportunity to experience and come to really understand how these plans operate and their purpose. And I think I mentioned that to at least one of you in private interviews that, you know, I always fall back to the primary objective of these plans, and that is to provide security in retirement or security in disability, et cetera. And I think when you have that kind of perspective, you find that a lot of things can be done. My work with Taft-Hartley's, you know, contrary to a lot of public perception, my work has been an experience, an observation has been that the trusts work well together because the people, regardless of where the position they're coming from, are there for the same reason, and that is to, again, provide security in retirement. So I think that, you know, I'm not, in addition to that experience, I bring those observations and a willingness to work hard. I mentioned also that I do a bit of volunteering and have done quite a bit in the community, but this would be the first time that I've been able to bring my professional experience to a volunteer opportunity, so I look forward to doing that.
Well, thank you very much. Council, questions? I think you've actually met with or had a conversation with all my colleagues, so they've had a chance to pepper you with the tough ones. I would like to, before we proceed to a vote on your nomination, I would like to announce something the mayor shared with me and Ms. Deckard shared with me. As we know, Yvonne Deckard serves as the chair of the fund and is retiring this spring, but the mayor has asked her and she has agreed to continue serving as the chair through the balance of her term, which is December 31st, 2012. At which time the council will then vote on a successor to Yvonne as the chair. So thank you both for your willingness to serve. And has anyone signed up to testify?
No.
Okay, if you could please call the roll.
Fritz.
Well, thank you very much for your willingness to serve, and thank you, Yvonne, for being willing to continue chairing the committee. You've been a really strong voice for reason and for balance on that. And so it's my understanding that two of the seats on the five-member board are nominated by the police and fire unions, and two are at large nominated by the council as a whole and working with the mayor, and then the mayor appoints the chair. So it's important to me that you are going to have the balance and that you have the experience to be one of the citizens at large, and so I greatly appreciate your service. Aye.
Salzman.
I want to thank, first of all, I want to thank Yvonne for agreeing to, she's done a great job as chair and for agreeing to continue to to chair the committee for the rest of this calendar year, so thank you for that. And Mr. Dougherty, I did meet with you, and I think that, you know, what there is a certain creative tension with the new reformed Fire Police Disability Retirement Fund and the board. And that creative tension is reflected, I think, by the fact there are two union seats and two citizen seats, and then the mayor's appointee. And I think that, you know, it's responsible. I think you have, you know, what's most important to me was you have relevant experience, being an actuary for over 30 years, definitely is the relevant experience we need on that board. And you are impartial, and you have, you know, have the ability to be impartial. And I know in our conversation, you understood that while the, you know, the fundamental responsibility of the Board of Trustees is to the beneficiaries, but the citizen members also have to bear in mind the obligations and responsibilities to citizens and taxpayers. And I don't think we would have had the tremendous 82% or 81% passage of the reforms in 2006 if it weren't for the fact that when people get their property tax bills, they are pretty irate about a large amount. I think it's still about the second or third largest line item on their property tax bill, the Fire Police Disability and Retirement Fund. So we have, the voters instituted some changes to bring those down, but and I know that you will bear that responsibility and acknowledge your role is also to represent taxpayer interests and citizen interests on this board. And so I'm pleased to have you on board and enthusiastically vote yes.
Leonard.
I, too, met with Mr. Dougherty, and I appreciated our meeting. And at our meeting, I don't remember if he asked me for advice or suggestions, but I gave my own experience as a member of the council as an example. I have a background in representing firefighters. I have a background in the labor movement. But I've never been unclear in my mind what my role has been either here or any position I've ever been in, whether it was in the legislature or myself as a member of the FPD&R board for 12 years. And that is when a case presents itself to me to use my best judgment to decide the case. And that doesn't always put me in good stead with people who had a certain expectation of how I would vote. But I said then, and I would tell you now, that that's the obligation that one has in a position that you're in. And for an example, in my last reelection, because I use that screen to decide whatever it is that I'm voting on, the Firefighters Union refused to endorse me my last time I ran. And while that stung a little bit in the longer term, it actually vindicated for me that I do the best I can, and that doesn't always mean that people that have a certain expectation of how I will vote will get what they want. And there are replete other examples where unions have filed grievances and unfair labor practices since I've been on the council as a direct result of what I think is my obligation, that is to use my best judgment. So that's what I would say to you is don't let anybody pigeonhole you. Don't let anybody pressure you. You know what you know. You're here in front of us after quite a vetting process, because we each expect you to do nothing more than use your best judgment. So I appreciate your service. Aye.
Fish.
Well, Mr. Dougherty, I enjoyed our chance to talk about your interest in this position, and I appreciated our conversation. This is one of the toughest assignments, I think, in our city. The stakes are very high. There's a lot of eyes on what you're going to be doing. And the decisions impact people's lives. What impressed me was the breadth of your professional experience, your desire to be involved at a higher level in public service. And frankly, I can't remember the last time on something like this where I received not a single criticism from anyone from the public. Maybe we didn't get the notice out widely enough, but I have not received a single comment from any person objecting to your nomination, and that does not always happen. So thank you for stepping up and agreeing to serve. Whatever my office, my colleague's office, whatever we can do to make you successful, don't hesitate to call on us, and we look forward to working with you as we move forward. Aye. Your nomination is approved. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Sue, that concludes our time certain. We have two items on the regular agenda. Sue, would you please read the first, item number 70?
Extend the city 2008-2012 Equal Employment Opportunity Affirmative Action Plan for 1 year to June 30, 2013.
Welcome back, Ms. Deckard. What do we have before us?
Good morning. I'm Yvonne Decker, Director for the Bureau of Human Resources. In 2008, the City Council passed the current affirmative action plan in which we are obligated to file with the federal government. And that plan had a life from 2008 to July 1 of 2008 to June 30th of 2012. So what I'd like to do today is, what you have before you is a ordinance to extend the plan for an additional year. I want to give you a quick report on how the plan has the accomplishments of the city under the current plan for the last couple of years for FY 9-10 and 10-11. We're still pulling up our data for this current fiscal year and won't have that until the end of the fiscal year. But in FY 9-10, we actually saw a 209 new hires into the city. And then last year we saw, even though we had a hiring freeze, we actually saw 345 new hires into the city. We didn't have the hiring freeze last year. It was in 2009. That's why that number is down. Out of the 345 new hires this past fiscal year, we actually only increased the workforce by 62 new employees. And so a lot of those new hires were not new positions to the city. Only 62 of them were actually new positions that resulted in an increase to our overall numbers. But out of those 62 new positions, 52 of those new hires were protected class minorities.
Could you give me that number again, please?
Out of the 62 new positions to our workforce, increased to our workforce, 52 of those new hires were ethnic minorities into our workforce. And so that represented a 15.1% increase of total new hires into the various EEO classes that we have. The way that breaks down,
that was out of 345 total new hires?
Okay. We had new hires and we have replacements. And so out of the actual new hires, which were actually 62, so 62 new positions that were added to our budget and that were brand new to the city, 52 of those were protected class employees. Okay, and that represented an increase of about 15.1%.
But with the rest of the 345 transfers?
They were either transfers and promotions, but, you know, different categories. And so I'm going to get to the promotion piece also. What that breakdowns for us would be, we saw a increase for our various categories. So for Asians, it was 2.9%. African-Americans are, sorry, not African-Americans, but blacks, because there is a difference. African-Americans are included in the category of black, but not all blacks in that category are African-Americans. It was 5.8%, Hispanics 3.5% for American Indians and Native Alaskan Natives. It was 0.6%. Pacific Islanders, it was 0.6%. And then for what we have a new category that the feds came up with, which is two or more, it was 1.8. 39, as far as promotions are concerned, we had an increase of 17.8% of our promotions were ethnic minorities, and 36.5% were females in our promotions. And what we try to measure is two things. not only who are we bringing in that's new, but how are we actually promoting and growing individuals or employees in our various EEO classes that are currently here. And the reason that's important is because, you know, anytime we go through budget cuts in our system, because of we cut according to seniority, so the last people that we bring in are going to be the first people that we take out. And so it's always very important measure for an organization to also look at how they are promoting, you know, employees throughout our system and moving people up. And so to have that increase of 17.8% for minorities and 36.5% for women was a real accomplishment for us.
Can you tell me I need to understand that particular statistic. What is our overall level of minorities and women within city employees?
Minorities, 19.5%.
And women?
Female, 22. From 10-11, which is last fiscal year, which is the last snapshot that we have because we've completed that, we have 18% minorities and then 31.1% females.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry. These numbers are important to us because, as council knows, that we've gone through some pretty painful budget cuts. And so what it represents is that bureaus have worked, and we've worked really hard to maintain and to look at our cuts in more than ways that are just financial, and to really kind of make sure that we have that diversity throughout our organization, or that we are maintaining our diversity throughout our organization. We actually took a different tact when we put together this last affirmative action plan. And I'm going to step back a little bit. Before we put together this plan, the council adopted the citywide diversity development strategic plan that HR had put together. And that plan really called for a different approach to diversity. And as you know, there's a huge difference between diversity and affirmative action. Affirmative action is a legal program that requires that we go by a government census about concerning the number of work-ready individuals that we have in our area, and being able to reach parity or make sure that we have parity with representation to those numbers. Diversity takes us a lot farther than that. Diversity is really looking, being able to look at your organization and see your progress, and not have to, because you can reach parity in Oregon and in our area. In some of our EEO classes, we could hire a quarter of a person and reach parity, but that's not really a possibility. And so we really try to set our bar higher and really try to make sure that we can hit categories and hit groups of people who may not be counted under the census. So, for example, we have a large Eastern European population now that's in Portland. And it's important to us that we have representation when people come to do business with the city, and that we make sure that all of our citizens feel included in our services, and as we give services, that they're actually able to meet with people where they feel that there is some connection, which has been part of our desire, and as far as our diversity program is concerned. So one of the things that our strategic plan for our diversity development called for was a more active, action and activity on the bureaus. And so it called that we do an environmental assessment each year in each bureau as far as diversity is concerned, and making sure that our workplace and our managers and supervisors are positioned to know how to manage a multicultural workforce. And that we're actually going the extra mile. When we put together this last affirmative action plan that I'm recommending the extension on, we actually made sure that we tried to couple some of that diversity development strategic plan with our affirmative action plan. So for the first time, rather than HR just putting together the plan, what we did was we worked very collaboratively with every bureau within your portfolios, and really sitting with them and talking about, you know, how could they meet those diversity goals, and then because which caused us to go farther than just our affirmative action goals. Each bureau took a very active role in helping us to develop the plan. Council adopted the plan in 2008. I think that we've been able to continue to make progress within this plan. The reason we're asking to extend the plan for a year is we've started our efforts in developing the Office of Equity. And diversity, EEO, affirmative action, equity are all different things, but there is a common thread that goes through them. And so rather than to develop a new affirmative action plan at being so close to bringing on the new equity office and those equity efforts, I wanted to recommend that we actually extend this plan for 1 year, get the equity office up, get the equity director here, and then have that type of input and participation within our next affirmative action plan, which will be another, 3 to 5 year plan. I did not want to go out with a 3 to 5 year plan and not have our equity efforts in our equity office to have a role in putting that plan together. And so that's why I'm recommending that we extend it for a year. We do have to have an active plan in place. If we don't have an active plan in place, that compromises our ability to receive any type of federal grants, and we have a number of them, and so we want to make sure that we can keep those intact.
You know, if I could, your presentation raises an interesting issue in my mind, which is the difference between each of the three concepts you've identified: affirmative action, diversity, and equity. And in turn, the question of who takes the lead within the city on each of those missions. And as I have some sense, they are regulated differently, and there are privacy issues as well as compliance issues. And as we go forward, Yvonne, I think it would be helpful to understand where some of those lines are.
Okay.
Because as we as a council sort of give sharper relief to what is an Office of Equity and what is its primary focus, I think we also have to be mindful that there are certain issues which are going to remain the province of HR.
Right.
And that because of the privacy questions and the employment related issues, mm-hmm. they stay there. But so then how does HR interact with equity to make sure we're meeting and exceeding our goals? So I think that's going to be a good conversation going forward, so we're all clear about what each of those concepts means, who does what, and how the Office of Equity interacts on all three.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that for the affirmative action and the EEO part, which is, you know, has different legal criteria, that is the piece that I see as really staying with HR and staying under the HR umbrella. I would not, for lack of a better term, those things are very cumbersome. They are very legal driven. There are certain things that has to be done, and you will spend a lot of time just doing that. And I see equity and diversity as being very interactive as functions where you have to get out and interact with your communities, with your businesses, with your citizens, as well as with your bureaus. In order to do that, and my recommendation is going to be things like the citywide diversity council that we've put together and that we've worked with, that shifts to the equity office. But a lot of our diversity efforts, which really works very hand in glove with equity, is a good, you know, that those functions shift. But even shifting those functions, yes, HR and the equity office has to be a hand-in-glove, relationship in order to make sure that, one, not only that we are accomplishing both things, but that we are accomplishing both things well.
Thank you. Other council questions? Okay, so you'd like a vote on this so that we'd be extending the plan for one additional year?
Yes, until June 30th of 13.
Sue, did anyone sign up to testify in this matter?
No.
Right, would you please call the roll?
Is it an emergency?
No, this is a non-emergency.
It's a non-emergency, so it passes to second reading. But
if I may then just comment, because I wasn't
clear. My apologies.
Apparently. I wasn't clear on that either, Commissioner Fish. So I do thank you very much for your comments about the relationship between diversity, affirmative action,